No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. And we're excited tonight. It's a good time for statehood. Maria, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Michael. I'm fantastic, and congratulations, and I'm really thrilled that you're going to be able to share with us what went down this week and how historical that is. And then also with our guest, Eleanor Holmes Norton, in her 15th term as the delegate, and what she can shine a light on for our listeners to learn, too, because this is historic.
Yes, it is historic. In 15 terms, you're right. She may be the most popular politician in the history of the District of Columbia. And I don't know, she may have to fight it out with Frederick Douglass, who, by the way, just had a birthday, you know. So happy birthday, Frederick Douglass. He didn't know when his birthday was, so he got to pick a day, and he picked February 14th. So I guess he was a romantic guy. And so anyway,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it is my mother's birthday is February 14th. And she
is
was
that
born.
Right?
Yeah. Fabiola, F-A-B-I-O-L-A, but no one ever called her that. They called her Viola. And I'm actually visiting with her to help her continue the celebration. You know how us girls stretch things out.
Yeah, I know. We're still. We haven't even finished celebrating Mary's birthday, and hers was on the 9th. So
okay,
you know, it just goes on. But that's good. And you know when you get to that age, Maria, you should have like a week long celebration,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, 87. She's
87.
You know, the sole survivor of her siblings and her husband, and she's lived longer than any of her 9 siblings. So she's got some great genes going on, which I guess come down to me, too.
Yeah, let's hope.
Yeah,
that's great. And please wish her a happy birthday.
I will.
All
thank
of us.
You,
that's just amazing. And
can you walk us
week?
Through?
Yeah,
right.
let me tell you what happened this week. Our bill went, the D.C. statehood bill, H.R. 51, which has now been renamed because it's got amendments. It has a new number, but it was originally 51.
So now it's H.R. 5803.
5803, exactly. And that confused me at first. I'm like, what are they talking about? But that's because amendments were added to the bill by the people that introduced it, and they're technical things, you know, like where the boundaries were. And for those people that may not fully understand what the statehood bill is, it's an attempt to make the District of Columbia the 51st state by shrinking the size of the federal government enclave to Congress and the White House and other government buildings, and making the surrounding area where the population exists the 51st state. Go ahead.
They'll annex basically the land geographically from the federal buildings to what is considered, quote, the state of the District of Columbia?
Well, it's not really an annexation, because the Constitution, which established the district, says that the seat of government can be no larger than 10 miles square, but it can be as small as we want to make it.
Uh-huh.
So basically, they just shrink it down and the rest of the land where people actually reside becomes a new state, and the only residents of the federal enclave are the president and the first family, and they vote in the state from which they come anyway. They're represented. So Donald Trump is represented by the people, by the senators and members of the House from New York. It's really not an annexation. It's an adjustment. They change the size of the federal government, and the remaining area becomes a state.
So does that mean that the state is then named the District of Columbia, or where the federal buildings are is considered D.C., and then the state is called something else?
Well, I'll leave it up to you to ask the perfect question, because this is a little confusing. We had voted at one time that the state would be called New Columbia, but they changed that. The city council changed the name to Washington Douglas Commonwealth in recognition of Frederick Douglass. So this is a technicality that we may have to work out at some point to have Washington, D.C. and Washington, D.C. We'll have Washington, D.C., the national capital, and we'll have Washington, D.C., the new state, Washington Douglas Commonwealth. And a lot of people find that confusing, and it's been an argument. But at this point in time, I think our attitude is we have bigger fish to fry. Uh-huh. We first got to become a state. So they've changed the name for now. That could be changed too. It's all a matter of that. That would be up to the people of the District of Columbia to amend the constitution we passed a couple of years ago to change the name to something else. I don't know. Or maybe it'll stay Washington Douglas Commonwealth, and we'll see how the post office and some other people deal with that. But basically, the bill went into the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform to be amended.
Of which Delegate Norton is a member, right?
Of which Delegate Norton is a member, yes.
Okay.
And so it went in there basically to be marked up. And a markup is an amendment before it goes to the floor, an amending process before it goes to the floor. So the bill's presented, the committee discusses it, and then if they pass the bill, it gets reported out for a floor vote. So that's the next step, and that's a big deal. We haven't had a floor vote on a statehood bill since 1993, and when we had that vote, it didn't pass. It didn't pass the floor. This time, we expect it to pass because we have 223 co-sponsors, and all you need to pass the bill is 218 people. So with co-sponsors alone, if nobody but the co-sponsors vote for the bill, it'll pass. Mm-hmm. And so we're expecting it to pass. And Steny Hoyer tells us, Democratic leader tells us, that the bill will hit the floor prior to this summer. So we're expecting in the next couple of months for it to go to the floor and pass. And that's a very, very big deal. We have more co-sponsors than we've ever had before, 223 in the House. 35 in the Senate, rather. And so this is a big deal, and this is the next step. And once it passes the House, then it's taken over to the Senate and presented. And right now, it's not likely, given the partisan nature of Washington, D.C., that it's going to even get a hearing in the Senate. But nonetheless, it's still gone a long distance to be where it is right now. And, we're excited to have Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the introducer of the bill, on the show tonight to talk about next steps and where we go from here and what she thinks of the whole process.
So, Michael, before she joins us, can we go into the details? Because it occurred this week on Tuesday, February 11th.
Yes.
And you said that more than 7 hours went into it. What was that all about? How were those 7 hours consumed?
It was about, and this is a question that I have for Delegate Norton when she comes on, but it was the Republicans on the committee attempted to introduce 36 amendments to the bill. Each amendment needs to be discussed and debated and then voted on. Actually, what they ended up doing, I think that was that they threatened to do that, but what they ended up doing was putting in 16 amendments. So every amendment had to be discussed and voted on, and in all 16 cases, the amendments were defeated. So the bill came out, as they say, it came out a clean bill with no amendments. And the amendments were far afield. They were, you know, they threw everything but the kitchen sink at the bill.
And did this pass down party lines also?
Absolutely.
So 21 Democrats, 16 Republicans?
I don't know that that was the exact vote, but yes, only Democrats voted to pass, you know, move it to that floor, and Republicans voted against it. I don't know that all 21 Democrats voted. They weren't all present at any one time. So, but the majority, and it's a majority vote. So the majority voted in each case to defeat the amendments. Now, maybe on a later show we'll talk about it, because every time an amendment was defeated, the member called for a roll call vote. So there is a record of who voted, you know, on each vote. But they don't actually do the roll call vote at that point. If they had, oh my God, it would have been longer than 7 hours. At first, people were saying, Washington Post, for example, was saying it could be as long as 12 hours. So we were spared a few hours of debate on the bill, and it came out clean. And that's what's important to us. And it goes to the floor, and we'll hear from our guest in a few minutes, you know, what the next steps are. But everybody's pumped up. It's
what was it like to be in that room to watch all of your efforts come to fruition?
You know, it was bittersweet. It was it's a double-edged sword. It's good to be there, and it felt you know, wonderful to see the bill progress. But on the other hand, it's really, you know, I don't know if annoying is the right word, but to hear members of Congress stand up and just say ridiculous things, you know, to bring
like what? Can like you repeat some?
Yeah, like talking about gun rights. At one point, this was one of my favorite things that happened, I guess. At one point, the congressman, ranking member from North Carolina, held up a carry card, and he said that Congress had done a really great job running the District of Columbia. For example, they had reestablished the rights of Washingtonians to exercise their Second Amendment right and carry firearms. And he held up a carry card, and he said, here's my carry card in D.C., and I helped get this established. At that point, the congressman from Maryland said to him, Jamie Raskin said, I hope if we get a voter registration card for the people of Washington, D.C., that you will hold that up proudly, Congressman. So that's the kind of back and forth that went on. Eleanor will probably talk about this, but there were also things on immigration and abortion and
those were some of the amendments that they were offering D.C. for statehood.
Yes, and so of course our warrior on the Hill, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said, you can't make laws for a state that hasn't come into being yet. You know, they're trying to legislate, right?
You think?
But inside the state. So that sort of thing. And the amendments were from the sublime to the ridiculous. I mean, just crazy. Last time we were there, when the House debated the issue to begin with, before I put it into markup in the first hearing, they talked about parking spaces. So, it's just crazy. And now we have our Warrior of the Hill, Eleanor Holmes Norton, with us, and we're so proud to have her again Thank you, Congresswoman Norton, for coming back on the show. Congratulations for moving the bill forward. It's an amazing time for us, and we're so happy that you come back to discuss things with us.
Well, glad to be with you this evening.
And I would just, hi, Delegate Norton, this is Maria Sanchez, and I was just asking the senator, what was it like to be in the room? Was it surreal? Was it poignant? Was it emotional? Was it, did you feel some vindication? What was running through you when it passed?
I'm sorry, you were asking who?
Yeah, I'm asking you that question. What was it like for you?
You were asking one of the senators. I thought you were asking of the members of the United States Senate. Well, for me, who's carried this bill ever since I came to Congress in 1991, this was what I'd been striving for and would have gotten much earlier, except that most of my years in the Congress I've spent with Republicans in charge. When I first came to Congress, the first thing I did was get a statehood bill introduced, get hearings. At that time, conservative Democrats dominated the Democratic Party. And while I got a vote on the House floor, that did not win. But I've had to wait this many years until Democrats got firm control to finally get a bill to where I can now predict that this bill will pass this year in the 116th Congress in the year 2020.
Can we ask you, Delegate Norton, what happens now when it goes to the floor? Is it a different process? I mean, how does it work exactly? Is there a debate? Is there amendment? Yes. Can the bill be amended on the floor?
That probably will not be allowed because Democrats are in charge and they probably will not allow amendments on the floor. The party in charge gets to decide that through its rules committee. What happens now, Steny Hoyer, who is one of the strongest supporters of the bill and the majority leader of the Congress, and what happens now, according to Steny Hoyer, is that before the summer, this bill will indeed go to the floor of the House. You hear me predicting that the bill will pass. I do so because, unlike most bills, which go to the floor with a handful of co-sponsors, I went further and got enough co-sponsors for the bill to pass. So I have more than 218 co-sponsors, and that's what it needs to pass. Most bills have maybe 5 or 6 or maybe 10 or 12 co-sponsors, but the whip knows that the bill has enough votes to pass and brings it to the floor. But we've gone the extra mile, as D.C. has always had to do.
Well, absolutely right. 223 co-sponsors. That's an amazing record. Congratulations on that. You deserve credit for getting all those people in. It's just amazing. Let me ask you, will you think they'll make you Speaker pro temp? Will you preside?
Well, I did preside at part of the hearing, and I've got to decide whether I want to do that or whether I want to manage the bill on the floor.
Well, either way, I'm sure it'll be not only I'm sure it'll pass, and we're very thankful for that. And we know that once it passes, it will go on to the Senate. Where we'll have a different set of hurdles to come over, or overcome. Today in the Washington Post, one of the problems that somebody put in the opinion column of the Post said one of the problems in the Senate is that local elections have been nationalized. I want to ask you, since I sat there in the hearing and I heard all these amendments, gun rights, abortion, immigration, were these red herrings that were thrown up to inhibit the bill, or are these just people in an election year putting forth their favorite issues to get to get recognition for them? And can we expect more of that in the Senate, do you think?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think the latter is the case. Yes, they wanted to inhibit the bill, but they wanted to dress the bill up with their issues. Of course, you can't do that on a statehood bill. The state gets to decide, which is why we want statehood. You can't condition statehood. So they knew that this these could not pass, and so we can only assume that this was a bow to their own most conservative supporters.
Mm-hmm. So it helped establish what their agenda is, not what was really going to be able to occur.
That's precisely the case, and this has been their agenda. And frankly, they have used the District of Columbia in order to try to accomplish their agenda. For example, the district budget, consisting of billions of dollars raised exclusively in the district, nevertheless, has to come through the Senate before the district can spend its own money. The Republicans use that opportunity to try to do with our spending bill what you saw them do with the statehood bill, to obtain the amendments on abortion and the rest. And by the way, they've had many, many such amendments. Only two, there are two that are left. I got them off in the House because we took over the House in 2016. But the two that I haven't been able to get off are because of the Republican Senate. So I don't doubt that I have problems in the Senate. And the two I haven't been able to get off are one that would allow the district to spend its own local funds for abortions for poor women. Many, many states do that, but the district can't do that, even though I got the House to take that so-called rider or amendment off of the district appropriation. And the other is marijuana commercialization. 11 states have commercialized marijuana. The district wants to do the same, and that's another one I've not been able to get off. But those two illustrate why the district is so adamant to receive statehood, which gives us equal standing with the other states who could not have such burdens put on their local budgets or even come near to them. Nobody in the Republican Party would want to or would dare to.
Well, let me say first, on the First Amendment, I was arrested in front of Congress, in front of the Senate, with a few other people, and went to trial in protest of taking those benefits away from poor women in District Columbia. So, yes, I spent I did 45 minutes of hard time in the congressional lockup, and we went to court, and the judge said, to us, you're my hero, but even heroes can't sit in the street and block traffic, so you're guilty.
Senator, you've already paid the price.
Already paid the price. And the most ridiculous thing I have to say, this Congresswoman, is that we did it in traffic court. Because we don't have control over our own court system either. We had to watch a drunk driver video before we were prosecuted. But let me ask you, along that lines, since we are considering, and you know, and our first delegate was fond of saying, Walter Fauntleroy was fond of saying that we're too liberal, we're too black, we're too urban, we're too Democrat. Well, right now we have ballot measures locally that are being under consideration for decriminalizing sex work and also the use of psychedelic mushrooms. Do these things hurt us as we go up there to these conservatives? What do you think of that?
Well, you know, those are the kinds of things, by the way, the council hasn't even passed those things.
I know.
And yet they've been brought up in the Congress already. And those are, you know, at the far end of what the district does, but that's what the Republicans make hay of. Yeah. And you will undoubtedly see those issues raised again, probably on the House floor when this bill comes to the House floor.
Yikes.
Maria.
Delegate Norton, I'm curious, since you are very confident that this is going to pass on the floor before going to the Senate, is there momentum that you can get now for senators to be co-signers like you did with the first leg of this journey?
Senator Tom Cardin, who is our chief sponsor in the Senate, already has, I think, more than two-thirds of the Democrats in the Senate signed up. We already have 100 national organizations with track records of getting bills through the Senate signed up to help us when this bill comes over. So we've already had a press conference with them. So we're ready to roll.
Wow.
Well, we've lobbied. Our delegation has lobbied in the Senate, and we're proud to say that we worked with several members in the past year who have signed on. But we've also approached Republicans. We've approached Joni Ernst on the basis of the fact that there are 30,000 veterans in the District of Columbia who are totally disenfranchised, and she's a veteran. And also Tim Scott, who's an African-American congressman from South Carolina, on the basis that there are 300,000 African-Americans in the District of Columbia who are disenfranchised. But we haven't gotten anywhere with the two of them and a few others that we've talked to. This has become such a partisan battle. Any ideas how we break that gridlock?
Well, Tim Scott, for example, was in the House and a good friend of mine. And in fact, he and I co-sponsored legislation that passed the House together. That doesn't make him any less of a Republican when it comes to getting what will be seen as a Democratic state into the Senate. So we don't suggest that this is going to be easy. We suggest that getting it through the House is more than halfway.
Let me also ask you another question, which is really important to me, and I don't know how you feel about this, but last year, let me start by saying our delegation went to Iowa for the caucuses. We have a group called Iowans for DC Statehood who have amazingly gotten every Democratic candidate who's come to speak in Iowa to agree to stand up for statehood.
Yes, so I know that, and I think that was prescient, very good.
Yes, and we went out there for two reasons. One, because the press is everywhere, and part of our problem is getting the word out, right? We actually, when Delaney dropped out of the presidential race, he actually gave us his campaign bus. So we hung 51 banners all over it, drove it all over town.
Oh, and two, that is fabulous.
Yeah, a lot of people noticed it, because it was funny because we got to cover up his name everywhere, but we left all the patriotic stuff on there. So it really looked like we had designed us ourselves. We know from a poll that the DC vote did that 80% of America doesn't know the dilemma we're in. So what I want to ask you is, last year the district government spent 25 times as much on projects for the arts as they did for DC statehood. Shouldn't we be putting more money into this battle? Shouldn't we be going outside the District of Columbia more?
Well, we certainly should be going outside of the District of Columbia more. But I think, frankly, what we need, more money can always help. And I think the DC government is willing to do that, especially now as the bill gets through. But what I think we're lacking is a coordinated media strategy. We ought to be doing coordinated media with a DC statehood theme about twice or three times a week to get the message out. We'll never have enough money to get it out by getting money. There's 50 states here. But social media get us everywhere, and yet, though I've been talking about this for some time, it would be easy enough to do, no one has said, okay, I'm going to coordinate a strategy, and I will solicit people, and I will get suggestions for what the theme should be this week or twice this week. DC using its own social media to get the word out. I think that is the way, if you're talking today's terms, to do it and not try to get enough money. I don't care if you were the most the biggest state in the union, you could not get enough money to get this word out that way. And that's a kind of old-fashioned 20th century way of doing it anyway. The 21st century way of doing it is social media.
The elections are showing that. That's all they're talking about now, is that social media is driving the elections. And you're right, if you would coordinate and then people publish and then it gets retweeted or pushed out or shared or liked or what have you, that creates its own momentum. But you're right, you do need a strategist, yeah, who can coordinate. And the other thing that I think that I haven't heard much of is, forget the partisanship part. I'm a registered Republican. DC for statehood is what is right, it is what is fair, and it is what is ethical. Forget the politics part. That should be not even part of the conversation. And we don't hear that very much spoken about. What is right for the District of Columbia?
Well, in politics, right always takes second to what is possible and what is political. Here we have maybe the most political issue of all time, because you would add two senators who people think would be Democrats.
Right.
So it makes it, and statehood is always partisan. Most states have gotten into the union only when a counterpart state of another party has gotten into the union. So it's always partisan, and we've got to be prepared for that.
Yeah, I often talk about how people fought against Alaska, saying that they would never elect a Republican, and they fought against Hawaii, saying they would never elect a Democrat, which obviously has not been the case over the years. But, you know, they're calling this, the Washington Post and other publications, I've seen this several times, calling this the new darling of the Democratic Party, I think is what the Post called it. The issue is the darling of the Democratic Party. The statehood issue, we saw it as part of H.R. 1, for example, which was a major step forward, right? And now we see it going for a floor vote where it's going to pass, and the Democratic Party is finally embracing it. As you well know, we battled with them just 7 or 8 years ago to get it back in the platform. So what do you think has changed there? Why, besides your incredible effort, what else has changed that's led the Democratic Party to embrace this issue, do you think?
Well, I really think the Democratic Party has long embraced the issue. Mm-hmm. I've not usually had a lot of trouble getting it in the platform. I don't recall opposition in the Democratic Party to statehood. Indeed, I've been able to speak at all of our conventions. Sometimes I've been speaking for voting rights, and of course, recent years for statehood itself. So my party is not the problem.
Oh no, I think we're pretty sure what party is the problem. And it is a partisan vote, and you know it's going to be some heavy lifting in the Senate, you know. But if anybody can lead us in that direction, I know it's you, and that's the thing. You know, we really do need to come together on a media strategy and move forward. We've attempted to do a little bit of that through this show and through our website, Teach Democracy, but it's very, very little. And I wish we could all, you know, just stand stand behind you and push, because I think that's what we need. You know, I often talk about this kid that played on my daughter's soccer team when they were babies. They were like 6 or 7 years old. And this one kid got all the goals because he realized if he just kept on kicking the ball, sooner or later it would go in. And nobody's kicked the ball as hard as you have, Congresswoman Norton. We're all in your debt for that.
Well, I certainly appreciate all the help that you've given me, Senator. As you certainly you've been on this for a very, very long time.
Well, it's a good, you know, it's the right thing to do, right? I had a relative. I know your roots go way back, especially in the District of Columbia, not mine, but they go back in Massachusetts to where my great 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 grandfather was a member of the Continental Army, and that's what started me on this journey. Was I went and looked at DAR, I looked him up, and then I thought to myself, what would he think of me living in the District of Columbia without the rights that he fought to get and not doing anything about it? You know, even if I couldn't make it happen, right? I should be involved. It's kind of the family legacy. So, and I know you have
that's some legacy to put to, and it may explain why you've been so excellent and devoted to this issue.
Well, thanks so much. And we know your time is precious, so we're going to let you go. But thanks so much for being on the show. And I hope you'll come back for our celebration show.
Victory lap.
For the victory lap, when we finally get it through the floor. Thank you. I know that you have some really good friends up there in Jerry Connolly and Jamie Raskin and some of the other people on the committee who have fought hard to help you. But I think that our listeners should know that I think several of the co-sponsors came on because of the righteousness of our cause, but I think many of them also came on because of your stature. You've been in Congress for 15 terms. You're very well respected. And we couldn't have a better leader on this particular issue. So thank you.
Well, thank
and
you
congratulations.
Much, thank you for having thank you for having me on, and thank you for your intelligent energy applied to this issue.
Thank you, Congresswoman. Good night. Nice.
Good night.
So,
Senator Michael D. Brown, I think that what Congresswoman Norton has done, not only with this, but with her career. Not everybody might know that she got her law degree and her master's degree from Yale, and that she's a tenured professor of law at Georgetown University, and that Jimmy Carter appointed her to serve as the first woman to chair the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, that she's been named one of the 100 most important American women and one of the most powerful women in Washington. I mean, her career, her reputation is beyond reproach. I mean, she's a superstar.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what? If you read about the civil rights movement, this is a woman who in college, when law school, went down to help get freedom riders out of jail. Her history in the civil rights movement in the South, she knew all these people. You know, I've been lucky enough to meet a few people in my time, like John Lewis and Elijah Cummings and some of these Dick Gregory, some of these other civil rights leaders, but she knew them all well, and they all considered her a friend and an advisor and a confidant. In fact, I've heard rumors, I should have asked her this question, I didn't know if this is true, that some people thought she shouldn't have run for the job of delegate for the District of Columbia because she didn't have a vote, and there was so much more she could do. Maybe going to another place. Several people have done that. Ed Brooke, who was a Washingtonian and just an amazing, amazing United States senator, moved to Massachusetts and became a senator because there was nothing to run for here in Washington, D.C. But thankfully for us here in Washington, she didn't take that advice if it was in fact given to her, and she ran and she's been such an effective advocate for us. without a vote. You know, without a vote, my kids have gotten $10,000 a year to go to college because we don't have a college state, a state college system. Two of them have gotten that. And that's been a big, big help in paying for their – Pat and I have paid almost $300,000 to put our three children through school. And that what amounted to $80,000 really, really helped, or it would have been $80,000 more for us. So she's done that, and she's kept our gun laws reasonable. You know, a lot of people don't understand. You and I talk about the Second Amendment all the time. Neither one of us is afraid of guns, but a lot of people don't understand that the gun laws you have in Oklahoma and Texas are just not reasonable gun laws for the District of Columbia, where you have all these, where you have an urban environment and all these politicians and diplomats and you know, people in the city all the time. So she's fought hard to keep those in place, and she does it all without a vote. And let me tell you something. She may not have a vote, but she's pretty well respected up there.
Well, and obviously persuasive, charismatic, intelligent, and a leader.
Yeah, she's a brilliant, and she is a leader. I don't think that great leaders change things. I think they inspire the people around them to change things. And she certainly has been inspirational in her career. And this is coming from a guy, look, Delegate Norton and I have not always agreed on things, but like most people in Washington, D.C., I have the utmost respect for her and what she does. I mean, she gets like 96% of the vote. You know, I once had roll call. I once had roll call ask me, well, if you want to do something for the district, if you want to have an impact, why don't you run for delegate? And I said, well, if I ran for delegate against Eleanor Holmes Norton, I would vote for Eleanor Holmes Norton. You know, she's so eminently more qualified and such a great leader. So, yeah, we can't say enough good things about her.
So, Michael, call back to the previous question that you asked her and that she didn't answer. I was going to wanted to ask her. You asked what role would she play on the bill when it gets to the floor, and she said she would know more later. What are both of those roles, and what would do you think influenced her to take one over the other?
Well, Speaker Pro Tem is something they do all the time, right? They depending on the legislation, or maybe depending on whether Nancy Pelosi is available or not, they often give the honor of being speaker for the day or speaker for the issue to somebody who, you know, like Congresswoman Norton, who's introduced the bill, who's, you know, been important in pushing, moving the bill forward. So that's a more honorary thing. The floor manager, the person that manages the bill, is the one that, that makes sure everybody stays in line, right? And he's like the, he or she is like the whip. You know, her job is not to push people to the bill, but actually to make sure that procedurally it goes smoothly. And, you know, and that's certainly certainly a more important role, I think. And she may opt to do that. The Speaker Pro Tem, I think, is more of an honorary thing. And she certainly... by Congresswoman Maloney, who was chairman of the committee, you know, her committee was chaired by Elijah Cummings, and he was an amazing guy, and now it's been turned over, but they let Congresswoman Norton be the committee chair pro tem in the markup, you know, as part of it. And so maybe they'll do both. Maybe she'll manage the bill on the floor and then also for part of it, for the vote, be the speaker pro tem. And that would be nice. She deserves that honor. She's worked very, very hard on this. And look, lots of other people have worked on this. You know, it's true, but she has been the leader on this bill. And, you know, and we're getting closer every day. And, you know, Maria, it's exactly what you say. This is why I asked her about the money, because the thing you said about politics not being involved in it, when mm-hmm. you get out to the public, that's the way they feel. Republicans don't say to me that we shouldn't have the same rights. I mean, on the most part, when I talk to Republicans one-on-one, I mean, there are a few that do, but for the most part, they say, of course, you should have the same rights that everybody else has.
Yes, those are the conversations I have. One, the ignorance, and I don't mean that to sound pejorative.
Right,
they're like, what? Are you kidding me? And I'm like, nope. And then two, they were like, of course. They don't even go to that two senators that are going to be Democrat.
Right.
In their mind, it's like, what's right? What's fair? Let's get parity. Or what are we doing here? And it's like, I know. So I have this conversation often because people will ask me about shadow politics and the program on BBS radio. When I tell them, like I say, well, Senator Michael D. Brown from the District of Columbia, even that doesn't stop people from having a disconnect. That they just assume that the District of Columbia, of course.
Right. Well, you know, when I told the stories many times where I go outside the District of Columbia, and yeah, they treat me exactly like they would treat any other United States senator, because that is the assumption. The assumption is that of course you have the same representation. And I also tell the story about speaking one time. My brother, as you know, is a retired president of a college, and he invited me to speak one time at a conference in front of college presidents. And, you know, I spoke in front of a room of like 75 people, each one of whom had a doctorate degree. Mm-hmm. And they all knew that we didn't have representation, but they didn't understand the extent of our disenfranchisement. For example, right. When I said we don't get to spend our tax money, one of them said, oh, you mean the money the federal government gives you? And I go, no, our local taxes. Another one said, no, not your local taxes, not like your sales tax and your property tax. And we're like, yeah. Our sales tax and our property tax. And it took me saying it two or three times for them to wrap their heads around.
Yes.
Like, what?
Yes.
What is that?
Yes.
You know? And so when people, especially when they hear the details of what, you know, this amounts to, they're really surprised by it, and they're really supportive. America supports this idea, and we need to get it out there. I didn't get to ask her, and I don't know that she would have wanted to comment on this anyway, but, you know, part of our problem is they brought up, I asked her about sex work and psychedelic mushrooms.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just seems, I guess I'm an old timer, but that just seems way out there for me. But also they brought up the fact of corruption. Since I've been elected, our city council, which consists of 13 members, 7 of them have either gone to jail, have resigned from office, or have been beaten for re-election in the midst of investigations of their malfeasance. So they bring this up all the time. The latest is a guy named Jack Evans, who amazingly resigned from the council a week before the council was going to expel him, and now he's running for re-election.
Is he?
Oh, yeah.
That's his workaround, huh?
Yeah. I can't believe that it's going to happen. But he's out there. He's registered. Look, this is how ridiculous it is. Because he's resigned, there has to be a special election. The special election is like a week or two after the primary election. So there'll be two elections for his position. He's signed up to run in both elections. If, for example, because there are a lot of people running, if, for example, he were to win, the council could very likely expel him, and that would trigger yet a third election for this office. And so it's just kind of crazy. And
I can't believe with what he has done and his wife and her connections and him not recusing himself from votes that benefited her company. And I mean, when I looked into it, the case was like egregious and 30 years in the making.
Well, and look, it's not even just the District of Columbia board, you know, city council that was ready to expel him. The Metro Board, where he served as chairman, for people that don't understand what the Metro Board is, in D.C., we have a transit system which spans Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. So there are representatives from all three jurisdictions that sit on the board that controls this multi-billion dollar metro system. And he was chairman of that board. Well, just for what he did on the Metro Board, for the things that you're talking about that he did in the city government, he also did it with people that work with Metro. You can imagine there are hundreds of millions of dollars at stake to vendors and, you know, for everything from buying new cars to track repair to PR to, you know, everything you can imagine with the transit system. They threw him off the board. He resigned from the board because they were about to expel him from the board. So it's not even just, you know, the people in D.C. right. who have expelled him. It's also people in Maryland and Virginia who represent people from Maryland and Virginia. So it's kind of crazy, I think, that he's going forth with this. And I like Jack Evans. He stood up for our delegation in the past. But there's got to be a bottom line. You know, I think if you can tell Pete Rose he can't be in the Hall of Fame,
right.
And you can tell Lance Armstrong that, strip him of his titles, telling people, work with me and give me money and I'll get you government contracts, that really needs to be the bottom line for a politician, right?
Yes, most definitely. And he must have no shame. Well, his ego must be enormous.
I guess. I don't know.
Come on. You did wrong things.
I know. And you know what? In the Roman Senate, if you were convicted of taking bribes, they cut your nose off, stuffed you in a bag with a wild animal, and threw you in the river. I don't suggest that we do that with Jack, but I'm just saying, you know, it really is kind of the ultimate crime.
How about just call it a day? You know, you had a good 30 years.
Right, you had a good 30 years. And you're a lawyer. You haven't been disbarred. You know,
right.
there's things you can do. His life's not over. It just needs to go on to the next chapter.
Yes.
And again, you know, he hasn't been particularly contrite about it either. You know, it's not that we don't believe in redemption, but, you know, go volunteer.
You have to apologize first.
Yeah, not only apologize, but go build houses with Jimmy Carter for the poor
yes.
for a few years, you know,
yes.
or go mentor children that you know, are underprivileged and need help. Do something. Do the road to redemption shouldn't be like a toll road. Yeah. You know, it ought to be a road that you have to walk down and to redeem yourself, I think.
So when do you know the date that it does go to the floor?
I don't know, but this is the conventional wisdom right now, is that it's an election year. The summer is just going to be both conventions mm-hmm. and election stuff. So it's probably going to be, you know, if I had to guess, I would say it will be in the next 90 to 120 days.
Because you're voting in June, right, D.C.?
Yes, we are voting in June. But by then, it's going to be, you know, just a raucous battle, it looks like. And look, I'm a superdelegate, and they're talking about going to a battle at the convention. There's never been a battle at the convention. I've been to 11 conventions, and the last battle was the first convention I went to over 40 years ago, and it was Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, and it lasted about 3.5 seconds. They took a vote. Carter won. That was it. The Kennedy people challenged him. It was over. But now they're talking about a brokered convention. That not only would be wild, but it would put me and the other superdelegates in a really really interesting position. So that'll be a good show.
I was just going to say, you opened up something now, and we don't have any time to explore it, so we'll have to go into that.
Next time.
Yeah, okay. Because that's something that I think the average person wouldn't understand, including me.
Well, we'll explain it maybe next time.
Okay.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to play you out with a song tonight from the Supremes, from Diana Ross. And this goes out to every single person, including Maria Sanchez, who was a D.C. statehood champion in 2019, who have worked on D.C. statehood, and especially Eleanor Holmes Norton. We'll see you next week.
Yes. Good evening. Thank you for listening.
Give the people their right to vote.